Hello, this is Ray Mock, the Executive Director of the Miami University Alumni Association. As a dues-paying member, you have shown a desire to maintain your connection to Miami. Our goal is to help you keep that connection strong. With these Your Connected audio podcasts, we hope to bring you a little bit of Miami in an easy-to-use and informative format. Check back regularly to keep up with the latest happenings around campus. Hear what's being taught in the classroom, and learn how alumni can continue to play a key role in the university. So sit back and enjoy these lectures from some of Miami's most accomplished faculty. And best of all, there will be no quizzes or exams.
Thank you very much. As Linda pointed out, I have the honor to be the Jack Anderson Professor of Finance at Miami. Jack Anderson is class of 1949. He is still very active and involved in university and Farmer School of Business activities, and I'd like to thank him publicly for his support. All right, well, an economic outlook for the next 5 to 10 years. I love this stuff. Okay, here we go. I'm going to go over a whole broad range of quasi-related and interrelated things. I hope to give a relatively brief presentation hitting the good, the bad, and the ugly of some of the things that I'm looking at over the next few years. And then I'd like to open it up to questions, and we can sort of have a free-for-all on what you perhaps think is going on. Now, in anticipation of some of your concerns, I would like to point out that I have successfully predicted, like many economists, 7 of the last 4 downturns and 5 of the last 3 bull markets. He who lives by the crystal ball must be prepared to eat ground glass. So, on that note, I also have to point out that the views and opinions expressed in this presentation are strictly those of the presenter and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of the employees, faculty, or administration of the Farmer School of Business, Miami University, or the state of Ohio, because they're just too chicken to belly up to the bar and tell you what they think. Yay. So, what I want to do is I want to set the context, first of all. And the question is, there's that old saying, you know, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon we have serious money, all right? And what I want to do is sort of put in context for you what a billion is. So a billion seconds ago, it was September 1977, okay? A billion minutes ago, it was 107 AD, okay? A billion hours ago, it was roughly 112,000 BC, and we were sort of crawling and clawing our way out of the ooze. How much is a million then? $1 million is how much the US government spends in 11.4 seconds. Okay? $1 million is how much the US government is currently spending in Iraq in 5.2 minutes. Okay? Did I mention that the price of oil closed at 103? Okay? That was pretty scary. And gasoline is now officially $3.15 a gallon on average somewhere throughout the United States. But more troubling than any of this is what happened yesterday. I know you guys are all thinking a 315-point decline on the Dow. That's not what scares me. Wheat closed at over $12 a bushel. Wheat closing at over $12 a bushel is going to affect everything from the price of bread to cat food, okay? Wheat is in almost everything, right? Right down to shampoo and hair lotion and you name it, it's got wheat or wheat products in it, it's gonna get. That's in booze, I know that. Anyway, so let me set a couple other things for you here, all right? Let's talk just a minute about Iran's oil production, okay? Now, Iran has the world's 4th largest reserves of oil. And as you can see, there has been a certain decline over time as to the actual amount of production that they have been pumping out. Okay? There is a concern also about their nuclear capabilities, although I must confess that I don't see their nuclear capabilities quite as frightening as some members of my government. I would point out that there are a number of other nuclear-armed countries that I find a lot more frightening. Pakistan is one. Okay? And nobody really knows what's going on in North Korea. And if you take a look at a map, and I advise everybody to do this, please go on the internet and search for a picture of the world at night. And when you take a look at a picture of the world at night, what you will find is the United States and Western Europe lit up like a Christmas tree. You will see South Korea lit up like a Christmas tree. And then a black hole starts. And I think that description of some of these countries as a black hole is really important for reasons that will become apparent a little later. So just sort of keep in mind that not everything is open and above board, despite the previous lecture on how fast and instantaneous news travels on the internet. The good news, as I see it, is that Iran is years and years away from any kind of nuclear weapons program. I don't think we need to worry about that too much. The bad news is falls into several categories. The bad news, first of all, is that there's certain destabilizing element in the Middle East with respect to Iran, its political ventures in Iraq, and its attitude towards Israel. I find that disquieting. What is even more concerning to me, however, is geography. The Straits of Hormuz are 21 miles wide. 30% of the world's oil passes through the Straits of Hormuz. Okay? Iran has arguably the largest small boat navy in the world. They actually have two navies. The first navy is the regular military service. It comprises three submarines, 20 frigates and light attack craft, and hundreds of smaller, almost unarmed attack craft. The Iranian Republican Guard also has a navy, and it comprises literally thousands of light attack craft. And you've probably seen them buzzing the American destroyers in the Gulf. You've probably all seen that video on the television. If you were in an American destroyer, you could swat it like a fly. But I would ask you, how many oil tankers are armed? Okay? And when you have thousands of light attack craft, you don't even have to attack an oil tanker. All you have to do is drive them back and forth across a 21-mile strait. Okay? Just slow them down. You want to talk about $110 oil, $120 oil? With the elections coming in November, a new president coming on in January, this is not a time to be provoking a country that can control the Straits of Hormuz. Okay? The real ugly thing with respect to Iran's oil production is please, please, please let us not have a hurricane in the Gulf. All right? That would be very nasty, because if we knock out Gulf oil, oil production, then the price of oil is just going to go straight up. I would also like to put to rest something that the conspiracy theorists often put forward, and that is that Iraq, the argument for going into Iraq was purely an oil, let's control the oil issue. I find this argument unconvincing, and the reason I find it unconvincing is one of the world's largest reserves of oil is in Venezuela. It's an awful lot closer. There's a dictator down there too, and an awful lot of people over here speak the language over there. And so it would be a lot easier. If it was an oil argument, Venezuela was a lot closer and easier to do than Iraq. So I would like to sort of put that aside. I think the conspiracy theorists are absolutely wrong on that. Let's take a look at another problem. This is Iraq's oil production. And Iraq used to pump 2.6 million barrels of oil a day. They are now down to about 1.6 million barrels of oil a day, and about 500,000 barrels of oil a day get siphoned off and disappears. The real problem with respect to Iraq's oil production is that this was supposed to be how we were going to pay for the hostilities there. And unfortunately, one of the biggest problems is the pipeline that goes from Kirkuk into Turkey. It's something in the neighborhood of 271 miles long and is virtually undefended. It is almost impossible to defend a pipeline that long. They pump 200,000 barrels of oil a day through that pipeline at $100 a barrel. That's $20 million a day that keeps getting interrupted. That could be used for something else. Okay. The other problem with respect to Iraq is that oil is not oil is not oil. And what do I mean by this? What I mean by this is, if you pump oil out of the ground, you have to use technology. The technology that is currently in Iraq is old tech. And in fact, it is so badly maintained and it is so badly out of date that it is actually degrading the oil reserves. Despite the fact that we are trying to pump $2.5 billion a year into just maintaining the status quo in the Iraqi oil fields, what is happening is the reserves are degrading. Something has to be done, right? It is just that simple. The real interesting and perhaps the real ugly news with respect to this is the flagging American commitment to Iraq. Iraq has stated, and the Pentagon agrees, that they will not be able to defend their borders for the next 15 to 20 years. A complete withdrawal out of Iraq will leave a power vacuum. I think you know from the previous slide, one of the major players in the area. Okay. If that happens, the oil production out of Iraq, I guarantee, will go down even further. Okay. We have a, while I'm on the topic of Iraqi oil production, they pump 1.6 million barrels of oil a day, don't you know? They use about 500,000 barrels of oil themselves, but they don't have any refineries. They have to ship it out and then bring it back refined, okay? So it's a very serious problem in terms of getting sufficient energy for turn into gasoline or into oil products, okay? Their infrastructure just doesn't exist well enough to produce that kind of production. So enough about oil just for a second. Where are we, right? Well, we are here. This is the S&P 500. This is the Dow Jones Index. Of course, this only goes to the middle of January. We're actually right about here now, okay? We had a 315-point drop yesterday, okay? As I mentioned, the price of oil has gone over $100 a barrel. We have 100% probability, according to the futures market, that there will be another 50 basis point cut in the interest rate. This will in turn make the exchange rate go down, which will make imports more expensive. The other problem with this is, with the possible exception, as I mentioned in the earlier session, with the possible exception of an Amish quilt taken to market on horseback and traded for free-range chickens, nothing is made without the input of oil. Transportation, power, chemicals, fertilizer, all this requires oil. And it's going to be much more expensive. It's going to affect lower income much more than higher income, which means that retail spending is going to drop off. We've already seen a major problem in the housing market. The subprime indices, the AAA subprime index, is trading for 70 cents on the dollar. The AA subprime index is trading for 50 cents on the dollar. the triple B subprime index. These are all investment grade. Did I remember to tell you that? Okay. The triple B subprime index is trading at 17 cents on the dollar. The estimate is that we are only halfway through this subprime mess. Why is that? It's not that you can just write off the subprime debt as saying, oops, okay? But what happened is, and you may be hearing echoes of this in the market now, is the bond insurers. And if you remember, Warren Buffett recently offered to bail out some bond insurers. He would take their municipal bond index and give them money that they could use to prop up the rest of their operation, the rest of their operation being CDO swaps, and I'll explain that in a second. The municipalities are doing pretty well. The munis are doing quite well, and the reason is they're insured, they have a tax base, and what happens is even though they're rated between, some of them are rated even lower than triple B, but the municipalities generally trade like AAA credit. They're very reliable. They pay on time. I don't think there's been a default in a AAA municipal bond in something like 50 years, very long time. So what's happening is when these adjustable rate mortgages were sold into the marketplace, they were sold into the marketplace at a variable rate. Except the people who bought them didn't always want a variable rate. What they wanted was a fixed rate. Okay? So what they did was they engaged in something called a swap. And the way a swap works is every 6 months, they say, all right, you know that variable rate that we get? We'll give that to you, and you give me a fixed rate, okay? All right? And it's good, it's legal, there's nothing wrong with it. All right? And then what happens is the bottom falls out of the subprime because it's now trading on 17 cents on the dollar. Right? And all of a sudden, I can't give you the variable rate that you wanted, so why should you give me a fixed rate? That's called a default, and you have to write those off. Okay? The average balance sheet for a bank, financial institution, Citibank, JP Morgan, Bear Stearns, 90% debt, 10% equity. When you write something off, you write it off against the equity. Want to talk about bailouts? Let's go to Southeast Asia and Europe and try and get a bailout on this thing. That's why there have been all of these issuances of shares to basically foreign sovereigns to prop up what is essentially a bailout of the American financial institutions. Okay. I mentioned we were only halfway through this subprime mess. Okay, I reckon this default on these swaps, okay, this is known in the business as toxic waste. Okay, as anybody in the room who has ever been a banker can tell you, right? There's no such thing as a bad loan. Never has been a bad loan. There have been good loans that have gone bad, all right, but there's never been a bad loan. We're going to start writing off some bad loans, and it's going to get ugly. What makes this even worse is if this was just a one-to-one deal, it wouldn't be a problem. But Bear Stearns, as an example, which was one of the first investment banks to write off on subprime, I believe they wrote off $12 billion in one asset-backed category all by itself, were levered 60-60-1. All right? In other words, if you want to look at it as a balance sheet, $60 in debt, $1 of equity. All right? And that's why they shut that puppy down, right? And wrote it off, because there was no money there. So as I said, I think that this is going to be only the beginning of the problem. Now, the good news is we have a Federal Reserve System. Whew. This is good, because in a Federal Reserve System, we control monetary policy by good old Ben Bernanke, who, to his credit, is a very good academic and is known as an inflation hawk. So what he does is he reduces the interest rate in order to make credit easier to get for these large banks in order to prop up the financial system. Of course, as I mentioned, reducing the interest rate also makes the exchange rate go down, so all those imports that we bring in get more expensive, and that's called inflation. And you usually have to increase interest rates in order to fight inflation. So he's caught between a very big rock and a very large hard place. Okay. So what's worse, perhaps, is Ben Bernanke is running out of tools. And what I mean by that is, as I said, there's 100% expectation that he will further reduce interest rates by 50 basis points when the FOMC meets on March the 18th. Treasury bills, 3-month treasury bills, are currently trading at 2%. Okay? How many more times can he reduce it by 50 basis points? The last country that went to a zero discount rate was a country called Japan, and took 15 years to get out of their recession. Now, please don't interpret that as I'm saying America's going into a 15-year recession. I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination. The structure of the Japanese market with the Koretsus and the interlocking bank and corporate affiliations and shareholdings made that a much more complicated issue. Turns out that Ben Bernanke happens to be an expert on the Japanese economy when it went south. Okay? So that should only be interpreted as really good news. Okay? Please. I have to, in the earlier session, we had that discussion about Federal Express, right, being the economics paper for a Yale economics course, and he got a C. I'm hoping Ben got an A. Okay? So let's take a look at a couple of other things here and see what we've got. Here's change in income, all right? And this is median earnings by gender. This darker color here, this is for women. The lighter color is for men. And as you can see, now I should point out that the median household income is about $50,000. Right? It's not a lot of money, okay? It turns out that it's actually pretty grim. Because if I remember correctly, and I had it written down here somewhere, here we go. GDP per capita in the United States is $44,000. Okay. Public debt per capita is $31,000. Okay. And we're borrowing more and more all the time. Okay. So how would I interpret this? I would interpret this as median income, regardless of being a man or a woman, has been going negative. And this is year over year. This isn't cumulative. So, for example, women are 1.2% lower than they were the year before, and they were 1.3% lower than the year before, which is 1% lower than the year before. This is the change in average real household income by quintiles. Okay? So the wealthiest fifth of the households, right, between 2000 and 2006 saw their household income go up by 1%. Of course, if you happen to be poor, it went down by 4.5%. And which one would you like to define as middle class? Does it make any difference? Right? In other words, your income has basically taken a hit since 2000, and to quote a very famous political individual who was running for president, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago or 6 years ago? Now, this is coverage. This isn't healthcare costs. This is healthcare coverage. And as you can see, what has happened since 2000, when we had 64.2% of the American population covered by some form of health care, this has declined to 59.7%. I'm Canadian, all right? So health care is a completely different issue to me than it might be to you. Not that I collect Canadian health care, but and I have to tell you that you do not know how expensive something is until it's, quote, free, all right? And I will also say that I have never had better, faster, or more professional healthcare than I have in the United States. That's the other thing I would point out. But I have to tell you that there's a certain number of things about this that trouble me greatly. And I'm not the only one who's troubled about this. And I recommend that if you have a few moments, please look up David Walker. David Walker is the head of the GAO, the General Accounting Office. Please look up what he has to say. Regardless of your opinion on healthcare, okay, the single most fiscally irresponsible action in the last few years has been the prescription healthcare addition to Medicare, right? The reason for that is not that people may not need help for prescription healthcare. That's not the reason. The reason is nobody bothered to figure out how to pay for it, okay? The average healthcare deficit right now is $440,000 per household. The median income per household is $50,000. That's like having a mortgage 9-to-1 on your income, right? We are going to be, unless serious things are done, and there's only a couple of choices here, folks, right? Higher taxes, lower spending. Pick one, or both, right? We are going to be passing down an enormous debt to the children and the grandchildren of this generation. It's going to be absolutely terrible. To give you an example, it is estimated by, I believe it's 2020, that not only will Medicare not be able to pay for itself, Social Security can't pay for itself. If we take a look at what the total deficit is right now on healthcare and on Social Security, discounting back, okay, $53 trillion. Okay? Let me give you an example of how much money $53 trillion is, because I know that you know how much a million is, right? That's like 11.4 seconds. $53 trillion is 90% of the net worth of every American citizen, including Gates and Buffett. 90% of their net worth. And it's a debt, like it's gotta be paid. This isn't like Russia where you can have the communists come in and take over and say, hey, that's imperial debt, we don't owe you anymore, all right? You're talking about one of the most stable countries in the world. You're talking about the only country that has risk-free government bonds. You can't walk away from this debt. You're going to have to face it. You know, one of the things about doing a lecture like this is I feel all doomy and gloomy at the end of it, okay? But I'm smiling. I think there's good news. I haven't got to it yet. Okay, lunch is coming. Okay, so we have an absolute boatload full of money here. Again, getting back to the prescription drug plan, when the president signed that into law, the effect on the deficit was an increase of 40%. This is a Medicare deficit. It was an increase of about 40%. Okay, absolutely horrendous. Let's take a look at the international front here, and what I've just given you a look at here is the effect between the US dollar and the euro, the exchange rate, and the S&P 500. And what you can see is it looks like the S&P 500 is going up as the exchange rate goes down, and to a certain degree, that's true in that our exports are now cheaper. It is also true in a completely different sense. And that is, many of the world's largest multinational corporations are homed in the United States. And so their foreign operations, which are denominated in foreign currency, when it's translated back into US dollars, is looking better and better, all right? But as I mentioned in the earlier session, one of the things that is a bit of a problem with measuring profitability this way has to do with US tax law. And I'll just go over it very quickly for those of you who weren't here. In the United States, the corporate tax rate is about 30%. If you go overseas, there are many countries that, because they're trying to build up their economies, what they do is they give a lower tax rate. I believe, for example, that the tax rate in India is about 17%. I think Mexico is in about that range as well. Vietnam, I think, is closer to 10. And so what happens is you have these large U.S. multinationals making all this money overseas and being taxed at a very low rate. Okay? But if they bring the money back to the United States, it gets taxed at the U.S. rate. So it's advantageous to them to keep it overseas. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize this when they're looking at an income statement. And on an income statement, it looks like these companies are doing really well because net income is going way the heck up. And the example that I used earlier was Procter & Gamble. We had the treasurer of Procter & Gamble in the farmer's school the other week. And he was pointing out that he's got all this money all over the world. And he doesn't want to bring it back because he'll incur a tax liability. But he's got dividends that he has to pay on the shares of Procter & Gamble that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. That has to be paid in U.S. dollars. He's got bonuses that he has to pay to the head office staff at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, and that has to be paid in U.S. dollars. He's got bonds that are outstanding, that the interest and the principal have to be repaid on those, and those have to be paid in U.S. dollars. And he has to keep less productive operations in the United States so that he can earn enough U.S. dollars in conjunction with more borrowing in order to pay his demand for U.S. dollars. Right? He would like to move more operations overseas because it would be cheaper to do so, but then he wouldn't have access to as many U.S. dollars at the right rate. P&G is not alone. Okay? Be very suspicious of some of these income statements. The easiest way to see whether or not this is a problem for the company is to take the net income and divide it by the income before tax, and if that number is considerably less than 30%, you probably know that this company has an interesting cash flow issue. All right, and it's supposedly these issues are pointed out in the notes to the financial statements. I'm sure many of you have tried to read notes to the financial statements. Is obscure a good word? Okay. And I have to tell you, the only reason that those notes are obscure is because somebody doesn't really want you to know. All right. Let's just, you know, it's not very hard to say we have a cash flow problem, right? So here we have the budget deficit. And no, it's not like the commercial with the monkeys where I got it turned wrong. Okay? This unfortunately is very true. We are ending up trying to buy more and more from outside sources. It's going to get more and more expensive. We are presently spending $12 million an hour in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the real problem with it, this is the budget deficit. The money for Iraq and Afghanistan isn't in the budget. Okay, those are what the appropriations bills are, right? That's over and above the budget. The Pentagon portion of the budget is for defense, not counting the war, all right? It's a huge number. Okay. Here's some issues with interest rate concerns. As of Friday, this point here is here. Okay, because we've had an effective cut. Okay. One of the big concerns that, again, you will probably hear in the news media is, and China is accused of this all the time, is that they will change their reserve currency out of dollars. Okay. Particularly when you have the euro trading at $1.50. I find this unlikely. The reason I find it unlikely is because even the most conservative estimates show that by the year 2020, the American economy will still be roughly 20% larger than the European economy. What's more important is the structure of the United States financial markets. If we take a look at the European and, well, the Asian markets are still in their infancy, so we can basically forget about them. But the European markets, even though you have Euroland, there's really only about 5 countries that trade bonds. Okay? Europe grew up on a completely different system where family-owned businesses were the capitalist innovation, as opposed to the United States with broad shareholdings. As a result, the depths of the European equity markets are actually very thin. Okay? So trading there is very difficult. I mentioned earlier that it takes 4 to 5 times as long to divest a portfolio as it does to acquire it. And this is particularly true for illiquid stocks, and the majority of stocks in Europe would be considered illiquid by American standards. So I find it unlikely that they will change the reserve currency. The People's Republic of China right now owns the majority of the debt from here out. They just have to threaten a little bit in order to put a ripple in the system. Whether or not they'll actually do it is a completely different story. The People's Republic of China has a fixed exchange rate. It doesn't really float. And you have already seen in about 5 or 6 years ago, there was an attempt by the currency traders of the world to force the People's Republic to adjust the exchange rate. And the way they did that was by shorting the Hong Kong dollar under the argument that Hong Kong is part of the People's Republic of China. The Hong Kong dollar trades, we can short the Hong Kong dollar, and all the People's Republic did was boost it up. And the way they boosted it up was they bought back the shares, you may know them as red chips, right? They bought back shares of that. So the major shareholder now in a lot of these Hong Kong entities is the government of the People's Republic of China. And I don't know about you, but I don't think I would like a government being the major shareholder of any company that I'm interested in. Let's get to the nitty-gritty here. Okay. Inflation-adjusted numbers. For World War II, it cost $170 to train and equip a U.S. Marine. Okay. It cost $17,500 today to do the same job. Okay. It's estimated to be between $28,000 and $60,000 by the year 2020. One of the things that's really, really bad for weapon systems is sand. Okay. Now, defense contractors love the Democratic Party, right? And the reason they love the Democratic Party is because they build up stockpiles. Republican Party uses it. Okay. The problem here is it is not entirely clear, and please ask whoever you're considering voting for this question, are you going to bring the equipment out with you? Okay. This equipment, sandblasted, bomb blasted, you're trying to build up the Iraqi army, they can't defend their borders, I'm pretty sure we're going to be leaving an awful lot of equipment there. Okay, and we're just making new stuff. Yeah. That might be an investment strategy. But the issue remains the same, is that if there's any kind of, we're basically going to write off an awful lot of equipment coming up. Okay, that hasn't happened yet, but it's in all likelihood going to happen. To give you an idea of just what we're talking about here, I would like to point out to you that the United States has 84% of the total world spending on military items, okay? And you can just see the difference, right, between what the U.S. spends and what Russia, India, some of these other ones spend. What's really interesting about this is notice that these are the biggies here, right? Russia, China, India, the United States, and yet we often hear this call for NATO allies to contribute more to Iraq and Afghanistan, and the truth of the matter is that they don't have a whole lot of equipment either, right? The Canadians send medical teams, okay? Because medical teams are easier to train than warriors. there are a few warriors there, but nonetheless, the reason that I put this up is that this spending is going to continue for a considerable amount of time. Let me just reiterate one more time, just so that you sort of know where we are. Imports are more expensive. Medicare and Social Security are unfunded. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are off budget. Okay? They have to be paid for. There's not a lot of room now on interest rates. This market is going to go sideways for quite a while, my personal opinion. Okay? And something has to be done in terms of spending and in terms of taxation. Nobody likes higher taxes. But if we don't have higher taxes, I guarantee you, you are going to have much higher prices. One of the candidates for president has suggested freezing variable rate mortgages for a period of 5 years. I don't know who the economic advisor is for that, but I would certainly like to know how you do that. Okay? First, because here's the problem. One of two things is going to happen if you freeze interest rates like that. The first thing that's going to happen is all the ones that are not frozen, they're going to end up paying, subsidizing the ones that are frozen. That's the first thing that's going to happen. And second, you have already seen part of the problem with the subprime market, and that is the banks have been hit so hard that there's now a credit crunch. It is not that there are no buyers for houses. There's plenty of buyers for houses. That's not the problem. The problem is they can't get mortgages. Right? And that's a very different problem. To give you an example of how serious this subprime issue is, I was talking to some investment bankers at Morgan Stanley, and they were pointing out that they had done an analysis of the equity lines of credit for houses over the past year, and this is what got them scared. And what they did was they took a look at how much. When you have an equity line of credit, what you can do is you can write a check, right? And you can pay for something and it gets charged against your mortgage, right? Comes out of your equity line. And so my question to you is, what do you think the average amount on a check was? And if you're like me, you're gonna say $20,000. That's what I thought it was. And it was $100. People were using their equity line of credit as an ATM machine. So now we shut down the subprime market. You still need $100, folks, right? Where do you get it now? Credit cards. Okay? The average American has $9,500 on revolving credit credit card line. Okay. You go uptown Miami. I tell you, those kids are pulling out credit cards all the time. This has to be paid. I don't think you're going to see the prosperity that you saw in the 90s, is what I'm trying to tell you here. Let's get a little more specific. Profits are up. Profits might be a little illusory, though, because of the tax law, right? But relative wages and incomes of average Americans are down. Okay? More and more people are deeper in debt. The average is roughly $9,000. That's when I wrote this. It's gone up $500 in the last month on the new estimate. Okay? Job creation has not kept up with population growth, and poverty is on the rise. The increasing healthcare costs are eroding families' already declining income, and companies are going to resort to outsourcing and productivity improvements rather than increase labor to meet any increases in demand or increases in benefit expenses. Remember that benefits account for roughly 35% of salaries, of the salary wage bill. Okay? Military spending is going to continue as a major part of the government budget. Okay? The first and second quarter results are going to be weak. Okay? The S&P is up. Well, it was up when I wrote this. It's not up anymore. Okay? That's that ground glass thing. Okay. The housing market is slowing as predicted. Housing prices are off 15% on average. You don't want to know how much the housing prices are off in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's not unusual when you see a housing slowdown like this to drive by a housing place, and you know the cranes that they have to build the, you know, put string the steel? It's not unusual to drive by them and see that they're not working. In Scottsdale, Arizona, they've taken the cranes away and the building isn't finished. Okay? It's getting kind of scary out there. Okay? Subprime is going to impede the ability of banks to extend credit. Okay? The government borrowing more and more money means that there isn't as much money in the general economy for corporations, which means the only way that the corporation is going to be able to borrow more money is by offering higher and higher interest rates, which will be passed on to you. Unfortunately, there's likely to be more capital spending to get productivity gains rather than job creation per se. The average job creation right now, you have the politicians standing up and they tell you about all these jobs that are going on. The majority of the jobs are in the lower salary area. And to give you an idea, the average hourly wage for new jobs created over the last 6 months has been $17 an hour. That translates into an annual income of $36,360. Okay. We are, in all likelihood, going to see increases in computer-assisted robotics for IT services, okay, as opposed to increased numbers of line operators. The United States is no longer a manufacturing economy. It is primarily a service economy. Now, having said that, it's not entirely clear that the services are unrelated to manufacturing because of outsourcing. I am bullish on international and emerging market companies, mainly because of the exchange rate, and because I don't think those sectors are quite as integrated into the U.S. Business cycle. In all likelihood, the successful sectors will include insurance, but not bond insurers, okay, and telecom companies, because for as pointed out in the earlier lecture, everybody has one, right? The market for labor, in particular high-priced labor, with these types of expertise is likely to continue. Unfortunately, the United States is having a major problem in producing these types of people. The biggest problem, as I see it, in the U.S. educational system has to do with maths and sciences. I joke sometimes that I have students who, if they have to count past 10, have to start thinking about removing articles of clothing. The math skills are pretty weak. We really need to do something about the public school system. Public school system is failing. There are certain geographic areas that are likely to continue with expansion, in particular Texas and the Southwest, most notably Arizona and New Mexico. But that's usually driven by tax avoidance issues, and what is happening is in California, people are getting out. Okay, they can't afford the property taxes anymore. They cash out. They get $850,000 for a two-bedroom, 1,600-square-foot house. You can buy a hell of a house in Albuquerque for that kind of money. All right, you're likely to see more consolidation among smaller companies. All right. And what that will do, right, is you have smaller companies joining together. These are basically metal benders. They'll be joining together. You'll have layoffs at the line level because of economies of scale. And what you will need is one more quality control person or perhaps another accountant or something along those lines. So the job creation is not one for one. The potential for earnings disappointments is extremely high, especially in consumer discretionary sector. As far as energy industrials and technology, I'm kind of neutral on those because oil is very expensive and I want to, I have to see where the rest of the housing sector goes. Very bearish on some telecom manufacturing, the volatile and cyclical industry. That's a real nice way of saying automobiles, right? Are likely in for a very rough time. Outsourcing will increase, and the Midwest is going to continue to lose manufacturing capabilities, especially in auto-related industries, Honda notwithstanding. Okay. The majority of new positionings that will be opening up in Texas and the Southwest, it's going to be difficult, it's already difficult, to convince Midwesterners to relocate. And this is not me speculating here. This is coming out of job headhunters and job relocators and all that sort of stuff. They're having a terrible time trying to convince people in the Midwest to move. Family values is one of them. I mean, if you just take a look at the students from Miami University, their definition of moving away from home is going to Chicago, all right? It's not necessarily going to New York or Miami or London or Sydney. Okay? So it's going to be increasingly difficult to find domestic candidates because of the education system who are qualified in math and science. On the bright side, if we can solve immigration problems, okay, and I don't mean the immigration problem on the southern border or even on the northern border, I mean the H-1B problem. Okay? If we can solve the H-1B problem, then what we can do is we can import a lot of the talent. And that will be a good thing. And the bright part about that is that these people really don't mind relocating. So getting them into the right places is not going to be overly difficult. As I said, the future for airline, financial, and automotive stocks remains bleak at best. I expect at least one more major bankruptcy in 2008. The industry is represented by unions, especially the UAW, is going to be a huge challenge. The workers make unrealistic annual salaries. And not only that, it's being handled quite badly. If you take a look at the buyouts now, what is happening is GM and Ford are offering buyouts to workers. Some workers are taking it. They're hiring new workers at a lower wage. You've got two people side by side doing exactly the same job with $10 an hour difference in their salaries. Okay? This does not make for happy employees. Okay. The other thing that's difficult with them is the productivity changes. Workers are not generally as qualified in terms of transferability as their salaries would indicate. If you take a look at a GM car carries approximately $2,500 worth of insurance and pension expense for retired workers. It's a real problem. And the workers, if they're making $40 an hour, they're not making $40 an hour that a smaller business would pay them $40 an hour for. It's not that skilled labor. Okay? So I see the manufacturing sector as getting even smaller. The single greatest concern, as far as I believe, is unexpected economic shocks. Interest rate uncertainty due to long-term investor concerns. I would imagine that if we start having, I'll use the R word, when everybody else admits that we're in a recession, okay, I would imagine that long-term capital planning is going to be a real problem, and so people aren't going to be borrowing long-term. I think that there's going to be a huge inflation issue. Ben Bernanke has his work cut out for him here. I hope he's up to the job. We're going to have labor unrest due to these immigration issues. And this time I am also speaking about the southern border. We'll see price increases due to energy cost increases. There's going to be political uncertainty. This political uncertainty I'm referring to as the Midwest, as the Middle East rather. Regardless of your political leanings, whether you decide to stay in Iraq or get out of Iraq or do something with Iraq, all right, you still got to deal with Iran, and you still have to deal with Palestine. You still have to deal with Israel. That's political uncertainty. Okay, and this economic uncertainty due to military conflict. The president, I believe, has just indicated that he's going to be sending peacekeepers into Darfur. While many Americans do not believe that the United States should be the policeman of the world, the truth of the matter is the world expects the United States to be a policeman. Did I mention the military spending? Okay. That military spending is part of the budget, okay? So, there is, I would leave you on one last point, and that is, you do know that economics is defined as the dismal science, right? Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
When are you going back to Canada?
I'll have you know that Australia is looking really good right about now. Yes, ma'am. Actually, this is a very serious problem. I teach a class that invests $250,000 of the university's endowment. And these students pitch securities all the time as to what should be in this portfolio and what should not be in this portfolio. And they decided that oil, Chevron was being pitched the other day, and they decided that there was no upside in oil. And I said, hang on just a second here, right? Let's talk about this. Where are the Straits of Hormuz? Nobody could tell me. Okay, I said, okay, the Straits of Hormuz is the narrow part of the Persian Gulf. Can you tell me what countries are on either side of the Persian Gulf? If it ain't in uptown Oxford, Strait of Hormuz, I think, is on Brick Street somewhere. It's a very serious problem. Now, I see finance seniors, and so I see a lot of students that are interested in going into the financial sector. And all of a sudden, reality has hit in because they're finding it very, very difficult to get internships and to get full-time positions. And is finally beginning to hit home that looking for a job had better start being a full-time occupation. I've got students right now that have been looking unsuccessfully, bright students too, not students who I would consider to be questionable. Very, very bright students who have been looking for 8-9 months. And the decisions by the employers on whether or not to hire these students, GPA has nothing to do with this, okay? These are all really, really bright kids, right? The problem is, how do they convey themselves? Do they speak well? One of the things I have noticed, and this is actually going to be an interesting issue, is many of the employers are now asking for written essays almost, and they're being evaluated on their writing skills. Yeah. Remember the text messaging? As a financial economist, I know the difference between compliment and compliment, right? Many of the students don't, right? Spelling is an issue. It's a real issue. There's a lot of words that spell check gets, but the other way around.
You mentioned the impact that the prescription drug program
right.
had on the budget.
Yes.
Next president, or if in the future you have everybody covered by health care, what would the impact of that be, greater than the prescription drug? And to what extent would this triple R?
Well, you know, there's a politician who has a very good point. And the point is that what we have is, we don't really have a healthcare system at all, right? What we have is a sickness and disease treatment system. It's really what we have. And that what we really need is more of a prevention program, and that way not as many people will get ill. One of the problems is that, stop and think about who's not covered. All right? The people who are not covered are going to be people who aren't as healthy as the people who are covered, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be a problem. I think that I have a Canadian answer to the healthcare system, and that is it has always struck me as odd, and that is in the Declaration of Independence for the United States of America, it says very clearly to provide for the common defense. I would ask you a more dangerous enemy than disease. Okay? I think that's a question that I would like to have answered by a politician sometime. How you decide to do healthcare coverage is one question, but the issue that we need to address is the lesson of the prescription Medicare. How are we going to pay for it without burdening future generations? If we look to Europe, and Europe by no means has the answers to everything, I would ask you to take a look at Italy and Spain, both very staunch Catholic countries where the birth rate has fallen precipitously over the last few years. In fact, it is so bad in Italy that they estimate that by the year 2030, it will take one worker will be supporting six retirees. Okay? They have an absolutely horrendous problem. And the reason that they have a problem, and this speaks to the issue, is they have a defined benefit plan. You guys familiar with defined benefit plans? Okay, not a contribution plan, a benefit plan, where the government just writes the retirees the check and there you go. Well, that money has to come from somewhere. Okay? And there's not enough workers. This has issues in immigration too, right? Yeah.
I agonize daily for my grandchildren, and listening to you hasn't helped.
I didn't say that I was going to be, I'm a happy guy.
I wonder what happens when our generation passes, and maybe the baby boom, because a lot of what's going on is vested, isn't it?
Yeah, in fact, let me tell you about how serious the Medicare prescription thing is, okay? 2011. That's when the baby boomers can start accessing that plan, all right? And they have redefined the baby boom to include people born up into, 1960-something, all right? There's a passel of them, all right? And the average birth rate in the United States has declined. I believe that the only way out of this morass, and that's really what it is, the only way out of the morass is control spending, increase taxes, and do something about immigration. You've got to have workers, you got to have jobs, and you got to tax them, okay? Now, I'm not saying tax them at ridiculous rates, but you've got to get this economy moving again. And I think that is actually the safety valve. And instead of people getting very one-issue-like on certain political matter. You can't round up and deport 20 million people, right? It's not going to happen, all right? Now, you can deport all the felons you want, all right? But what you really have to do is you have to get people working, you have to get them in not the underground economy, but in the regular economy, so that they're contributing to society, so that wages find their appropriate level, and there's sufficient cash flow to the government to be able to provide the services that are necessary. And right now, it's looking pretty grim. It's lunchtime? Okay, last question, sorry. The fair tax, in my opinion, is anything but a fair tax. And the reason for that is, stop and think about for those of you who don't know what a fair tax is, the politician in question wants to get rid of the IRS, and what he wants to do is he wants to levy sort of a retail sales tax, for want of a better term, on all products. I find it disingenuous the way that he describes it as 30%, when in fact anybody who can do the math properly realizes that it's closer to 32, okay? But here's the problem. That tax will be levied on everything, okay? Gas, food, clothing, subject to exemptions, right? who pays more of their income on those items, rich people or poor people? Poor people. It will be extremely hard on the poor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this Your Connected podcast. Please check back for the latest podcast from your Miami University Alumni Association.